Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome. This is Cup of Joe, where we explore restoration history, and I'm your host, Karen Peter. Now, here at Cup of Joe, we partner with the Historic Sites Foundation to interview the presenters from their lecture series. And right now, we're in the process of interviewing the lecturers from the Spring 2022 lecture series. So today's interview, we have an interesting connection with the start of the Latter-day Saints Church in the Netherlands. And we're going to hear about that from our guest, who's going to share the development of the church in its first 25 years in the Netherlands and how this has led to two kind of regional strongholds in the Netherlands. And our guest, who's going to guide us through this discussion of the church in the Netherlands, is Kees Olangsma. And Kees is a convert to the Community of Christ. He was baptized when he was 17. And in his professional career, he was in marketing, sales, and business development, and was, in Friesland Campina. Is that how that's pronounced?
That's correct. Yep.
Okay. The world's largest dairy cooperative. And before his retirement in 2018, he visited over 50 countries in all continents except Oceania. And in the Community of Christ, Kees serves in the office of high priest. He's been a pastor of the largest congregation in Europe, and he's been and is a national leader and ministry coordinator. And I had the pleasure of meeting Kees several years ago when I got to visit Easter Camp in the Netherlands. And so I'm just really thrilled to be here with him today. So welcome, Kees.
Thank you, Karen. The pleasure is all mine.
Well, thank you. When we began our conversation, before we began to record, I mentioned to you that all of our Project Zion podcast series have kind of a coffee theme to them. And you said that in Dutch, there are lots of phrases that have to do with coffee drinking, which fits right in with our Project Zion theme. So even though I didn't ask you ahead of time, can you share one coffee term for us?
One of the most known and which is a little bit hard to translate, but I will give it a try, is that in Dutch you say niet zeuren voor koffie. That means that before coffee is being drunk, you should not discuss any items, which is early morning. First you have the coffee and then you do the business, because you need to be clear in your mind and have the coffee first. So a lot of Dutch people in their office, they start at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning to drink coffee. And they drink it all day until some people even late in the evening, and they still can sleep. So that's quite an achievement.
I think that's going to be one of my favorite coffee terms. No business before coffee. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's perfect for those of us who live out in the Seattle area in the United States, because that's our way of functioning as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kees, your contribution to the Historic Sites Foundation Spring Lecture Series is titled The Development of the Community of Christ in the Netherlands up to 1948. So this would be a really critical time in Europe when the church was developed in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And in your description, it says that the first desire to bring the restoration to the Netherlands dates back to 1840. So we're going back to when the church was one restoration movement before it divided with the schism.
That's
so briefly, can you tell us a little bit about those original efforts to kind of plant the restoration in the Netherlands at that time?
Yeah. It all started with what Orson Hyde would at that point would call a kind of a vision. And he said, I have a vision. And the vision is that in Europe, there are big groups of Jewish people in London, in Amsterdam, in Jerusalem, and in Constantinople, which nowadays we call Istanbul. And he said, those are the places we need to go. And along the way, we will take all kinds of other people. We will take them, Gentiles, we will take them along the route as well. So his vision, which he shared in 1840, got kind of a blessing from the head office. And in 1841, he left for Europe in order to do what he wanted to do. In some countries, he was successful. Like in Israel, there's still a what I see is an Orson Height garden in Jerusalem. In the Netherlands, he was not that successful. He was only there for a couple of months. And the only thing he wrote during those times was kind of a tourist brochures. He wrote how nice the town was and how clean the streets and how interesting the buildings, how many vessels in the harbor from all different nationalities. But he left without any convert in that same year, in 1841, in November, without no results at all. The only result, he spoke to a rabbi in Amsterdam who didn't speak English. So it was a difficult conversation. But out of that, one tract was translated. So that was already then, the first tract was translated into Dutch. But that was all. That was all his, let's say, coming out of his vision to find, let's say, new members in Amsterdam. That was the first attempt.
So that was, so out of that whole experience, one tract, one pamphlet.
That's it. Yeah.
Okay.
That was the total result.
Oh, dear. Of his, that must have been disappointing.
That was quite disappointing. Yeah. The interesting thing is, and I will make a sidestep here, because as I said in my introduction, there is a connection with the LDS history. Okay. Because in 1861, a Dutch guy converted to the LDS church, he was converted in Wales, then moved to Utah, and then was sent back to the Netherlands in order to bring the LDS, belief to the Netherlands. He was of Dutch origin. He was of Friesland origin. Friesland is one of the provinces in the north. You've been there, so you know, but many people don't. It's in the north. It's very close where I live, and it's very close where the largest congregation of the, that so-called, a Community of Christ congregation is. It's only 5 miles apart where the first LDS members were baptized and where the largest congregation of the Community of Christ is based, which was, you can call this a coincidence, but it also has to do, that is one of the learnings that's further down the line, but we can come to that now, is that in bringing the faith, the beliefs to a certain country, it's very helpful to have native people. People who have the roots, the origin in the country they are sent to. They speak the language, they have stamina, they have courage, and they are very much aware of, let's say, the culture, the habits of the people. So they are, so to speak, one of them. So it's very interesting that this gentleman, and there is also in my lecture, I will show you also the statue. There's a statue, big statue, based in that place. It's an interesting statue. And you see that he baptized his brother, his sister-in-law, and his sister. I've done some research, and from that whole family, none of them, stayed in the LDS church. So they all wandered off, and he eventually moved back to the United States. But it's very interesting that so close to the place where the Community of Christ is based, also the LDS church had his first members. And this, let's say, this ditch where it has happened, the ditch is still there. So you can still imagine how this has been happening over there.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
You could call it a coincidence, or you could call it the epicenter of restoration beliefs there in Friesland. That would be
because on the other part, and that's a little bit a part of the Christianity in itself. Christianity was very late in this part of Holland. It stayed, if you see Holland, you have the big rivers in the south, and then you have up north, which was all swampy area. It was flooded each autumn, each winter, because there were no dikes and dams yet. In my lecture, in my introduction, I will come to back a little bit about how Holland has been built. But Christianity was very late. The first missionaries from the, let's say, Roman Catholic Church were even killed over here. So people had a very strong nature belief. Everything was from nature. So Christianity was far away. And now you see that two so new faith movements, like the LDS and like the Communion, found some of their big bases in this part of the Netherlands, which was also interesting.
Yes, because it doesn't sound like it would be the most fertile soil for a religious movement to be planted if there's this almost, not animosity, but resistance, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a little bit of hostile surrounding.
Yes, okay, I'll let you say it. I didn't want to say that, but okay. Well,
okay, let me say it then.
Thank you. So that was 1861 when the LDS.
1861. Now we move a little bit further. In 1869, there is Elke Jasper, and who has been sent as the first missionary to the Netherlands. And he had a very the same short period as Orson Hyde. He was only there for a couple of months, and then he left. He said, nobody wants to support me. I'm starving here because I don't have money, and I'm coming back. However, he made a note in his reports that he made some converts in Zaandam, which is close to Amsterdam and Rotterdam. So there were some baptisms done, but they were never recorded.
Oh, okay.
And then it was silent for more than 50 years.
So this is what was interesting to me, is that in your lecture, you talk about how these original forays into planting the restoration in the Netherlands led to the establishment of what became the Community of Christ. So I'm assuming the RLDS tradition didn't happen until 1924.
That's correct. It was after 1869, nothing happened for 50 years.
So,
and then Frederick M. Smith visited Europe in 1920. Okay. He had a long trip. And he visited also the Netherlands. And there he found somebody who was a converted LDS member, which was John Graven. And he was converted already to the RLDS, let me put it, because that historically is easy to talk. They came in January 1921, and they baptized two of John Graven's sons. So those being recorded as the first baptisms in the Netherlands in 1921. But first basically is not accurate because the first were already in 1869, but never recorded. So we don't have names and places and people who did the baptism.
Okay. So 1921, people are baptized when F.M. Smith visited. The church then became officially established in 24. So if you can kind of share a little bit about that story and maybe where it came from there and how you found this information. I mean, how did you find that there were people baptized in 61 that weren't recorded? So let's talk about that and how hard this was to put together.
I must honestly say I had a lot of help from Joey Williams, because a lot of this information is coming from his paper. He has made a paper when he has his MAR study in 2004. And there was already another study being done to the Community of Christ. Then it was really in the old name, by another theology student in Holland. So there were already two sources. Together with Joey, some interviews were made, And when the church or some of the congregations were having its 40th or 50th anniversary, I also interviewed people from, let's say, the first period, from the first era. So all these notes we found, and we put them, well, we tried to put them as much as possible together, because that was one of the things we were running into. In those days, you had also to do with people who were illiterate. So not a lot of people wrote down in a diary or in a letter or in a book or in a notebook what they had experienced, or putting dates or numbers to it. People were also simple people. They were not skilled in writing, because they were handcrafts people. And as I am a convert in the community of Christ, I have no relatives, earlier generations. I have no grandmothers or grandfathers who've done it, or who have been there for many years, who knew people or could describe certain developments. So yeah, that's the way we got all this information together.
So I don't know what the experience was like for you personally. I love doing that kind of research and discovering things about the church, especially where I live, because I have an affinity with that. So how was this for you? What was most important to you when you learned about the church in the Netherlands? What are some of the challenges post-1924 that the church faced in the Netherlands? In 1924, I'm going to assume the Netherlands was still in recovery from what happened in Europe in the First World War. And yet, as we know, then comes a Second World War. So can we talk about the challenges the church faced growing in the Netherlands, what it was like, who were the people who first joined and made these large congregations?
Yeah, well, let me try to get that a little bit clear. One of the things which was very crucial was that there were a lot of open air services. So people went to the park and had a service over there. And I think the Community of Christ at that point was different from other churches, because there was a lot of singing. There was a lot of music. Music is also sound which people can hear from distances, which is intriguing to people. And especially in if you look to Rotterdam congregation, there was Ari Peil. He was the choir leader. He was already a choir leader before he came to the church. And he was also the first man who made a small hymnal, a small booklet of 50 hymns, which he found important for people to sing. And it took almost 100 years before we had our own hymnal, which we just presented last month, because this is our own hymnal, which has been published and it's for sale in bookshops, etc. Although music was so important, we as a church always had our own internal kind of hymnals, but we never went outside our borders, outside our community, until recently. So these open air services, which was the success in Rotterdam, was also the success in the other stronghold. Rotterdam is a big city, which is in the west. In north, there was the same story. We had Brother Veenstra, Fokke Veenstra, and he was just as the LDS missionary, he was a native. So he came from this area, the same area where I live. So he was one of them. He was not a big singer, but his wife was a great singer. So wherever she sung, there were 300 or 400 people present in order to hear how nice she could sing. So people came for her singing, and then Veenstra had a small service. He used simple words because people were simple. Handcrafts people in shipyards, farmers, agricultural workers, that type of, and trading people. There's a lot of trading people, But they were simple people, so they should have a simple message. So his message was very simple. He talked about injustice with other churches, because at that point there were very strict rules in several Dutch Reformed churches. He talked about continuous revelation, but he was also always talking about invitation, coming and to join. And those simple messages, together with the singing, inspired people and made people come in order to get baptized. So those are the, and that lead to two strongholds. So we had a stronghold in a big city like Rotterdam, and we had a stronghold on the countryside, because the place we're talking about is Zwartbesteinde, which is, and nowadays 5,000 inhabitants, in those days maybe only 2,000. So now we had, and the city and the countryside.
So you have, you've used the word that is music to a 70s ears when you said that he focused on invitation with his message. So everybody out there, remember that when we share our story of faith and our choice to walk that faith in community of Christ, that we also invite others to participate as well.
Our mission initiative start with that one, right?
Invite That's people the first to Christ. One to mention. Absolutely. Careful, Case. You might have a change of priesthood focus there. You don't want to give us any ideas here in the 70s.
Yeah. Don't talk to Larry, please.
So as you began to learn more about how it grew in the city and also in the country, I love the fact that music was so central to that growth. And it seems such a travesty that even though it was essential to the growth, that the church didn't have a hymnal in Dutch until now.
Mm-hmm.
Which is
very strange, which I came across when we discussed this in 2003, when the Community of Christ Sings was published. So I, as a national leader, I discussed it with Joey at that point, he being the Mission Center President for Europe at that time. And we discussed it, but there were also other projects we had to do. Many others, it had also to do with, which is items like, I think about sexual behavior and all these type of issues. Mm-hmm. That was also the reason why Sandy Gimay came over to Europe in order, together with me, set up a kind of study in order to teach leaders how to deal with those issues. So the trainer was her assignment, but it fell through because we couldn't find a university except the one in Seattle, and we found it a little bit too far from the Netherlands to move over there to do this study. And then we decided to put this hymnal first. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was a nice coincidence that Sandy Gimay was a music teacher, and she loved to do the project. So we started this 6 years project with volunteers, and we finished it just last month because, of course, also this project was hit by the Corona crisis. So the last 2 years, we had monthly conversations only on Zoom.
Right.
Everything should go on Zoom. So that was, but that led to, let's say, I can show it, because this is how it looks like.
I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's really a booklet.
Yeah.
And it's now it's for sale in bookshops. It's been bought by other choirs. So our message is now in as an invitation going to many other places we don't know where they end up, and we don't know what will be the end result of this. But I think choirs will find these new songs, these new texts, because there are many new texts appealing to people, like acceptance, like how to deal with the environment and how to do about peace and justice, etc. So those themes, which are very actual at the moment, are very well captured in the songs we have in this hymnal, which is all in Dutch.
What a gift that is, that will extend beyond the church. That's just marvelous. Yeah. That's marvelous. I'm so excited to hear about that. Case, when you began this research, I'm assuming that where you started with your understanding of the development of the church in the Netherlands is different from where you ended up. So what did you learn along the way that you think either was new to you or gave you new insight?
That there's always the intrigue. I've been to the World Conference several times, and before it starts, there's always the flag ceremony. So it starts with which country was first, which was the United States. I think Canada was second, and then suddenly the Netherlands is number five in a row, which I found intriguing, because I knew the church started only in 1924, and I could not imagine that we in 1924 we were only fifth in line. Which was an intriguing question, because when starting about history, you go back to your own congregation. That's where you start. You know where it is. But that congregation was from 1937. And I knew Rotterdam was first. So you go back to 1924. But we are fifth in the row in the flag ceremony. That comes off 1841. So what has happened between 1841 and 1924, which is quite an intriguing question. What has happened? So there the research started in order to see, filling the gaps. Yeah. But there was not so much to fill, because there was 1841, four months Orson Hyde, 1869, 4 months Elke Jesper, and that's it. And then we have to wait until the president himself comes along in 1920 in order to really start.
He put those early missionaries to shame, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Okay, guys, I will do it myself.
Exactly. So after finishing your lecture and doing all the research and your experience in putting the hymnal together and the other things that have been going on in the church in the Netherlands, what do you think is the most important... What are the most important aspects about the church in the Netherlands that people should know? Just as people listen to Project Zion or learn more about the church globally, what is important that we need to know about the church in the Netherlands?
I think one of the things, it's not particular to the Netherlands, but one of the things I learned is that if you're going on mission, and we've seen it in many occasions, we're going to mission and we send people to a certain country. And then after a couple of years, disappointed, they come back and say, it didn't work. I couldn't get it done. What we see in the RLDS church in the Netherlands, and also here with, let's say, the RLDS at that time, is that if you use natives, indigenous people who speak the language, who have the level of understanding what is, let's say, the habits in a certain country, what is the culture, what is the wording I should use in order to touch people's heart, not to speak their language, but to touch people's heart. Where should I? I think that's a big learning in order to get established or to get accepted and later on get established. I think that's a learning I got out of all these papers. And that's something also professionally, I've seen that many times, because we are a big company. We have appearance in various places. And of course, we used also expats. Big companies use expats. That's what they do. But if you really go to the heart of your consumer, if it is business or it is church, if you want to go to the heart, you should have local people in order to get things done. And I think that's a big learning for me. Another big learning for me was that music can be a great means in order to touch people. I think we all know, everybody at listening to this podcast will know that music can really touch your heart.
Mm-hmm.
Either in the wording or in the melody or in the combination of the two or in the occasion where it is. But music, it binds people, it puts people together, because one of the guys who was in our presentation with the hymnal, he said, music is the only way, the only moment everybody is on the same note. And that's true. Because
that's a beautiful sentiment.
We all meet this,
I was writing it down because it's such a beautiful sentiment. That's a beautiful statement. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's very clear. Is so then you feel as a group. One of the eyewitnesses of those open air meetings says that also. She said, we felt as a group, and we felt that everybody was part of that group. Nobody felt excluded from the group. It was all inclusive. Everybody accepted each other. And I think that's great with music. So that is my second learning. The church in the Netherlands, I think we always have been a kind of a liberal church in forefront of movements. Is it in peace and justice, or is it in LGBTQ issues, or many other issues? The Netherlands people are in that sense liberal. They look for freedom for people. They look for acceptance for people. So that's, I think, another learning.
I know when I visited Case, that tone of acceptance and kind of being on the cutting edge of what it meant to be progressive and open and mindful of these bigger matters that face us as humans was something that was really apparent to me. Mm-hmm. when I visited the church in the Netherlands, that people were interested in these bigger issues and how as a church we address them, we come together, we focus on them. So
yeah, sometimes we are a little bit over that edge, and we try to, let's say, as a small country of only 17 million people, we try to steer the whole world more or less. So sometimes we should be a little bit more modest and say, oh, hang on, we're just small. Don't shout that hard. We are only small. But still, yeah, that's a little bit the attitude we have.
I like it. I like that. And I like stopping for coffee every morning. So yes, those are good things about the Netherlands.
Yeah.
So as people listen to your lecture, they're going to be learning a little bit more about the church in the Netherlands. How can this experience of learning more in-depth understanding of the church in the Netherlands help our corporate discipleship and community of Christ, help us as a body of faithful followers?
I think it will at least show that each country has its own history, its own story. What you see in the Netherlands, for instance, it started in Rotterdam. Why did it start in Rotterdam? Because it's a big harbor, and everybody in those days came by steamboat, not by airplane. So all the steamboats came to Rotterdam. So the first stop in the Netherlands was a big harbor, which was Rotterdam. So it started from there. It was easy because you didn't travel all the way up to Friesland, which is 250 kilometers down. You don't go there because you don't know where to go. You don't know anybody. So it started where it's let's say, from logistical point of view, it was most easy to start. It didn't start in Amsterdam, which was Seth and Orson Heights' his talk. He talked about Amsterdam, but he started in Rotterdam because that was his first point of entrance.
So that Dutch pragmatism is showing as you talk about that case. Yeah. There's a phrase that used to be on greeting cards, and it said, bloom where you are planted. And that's kind of what this is. It's where you find yourself, that's where you begin.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So in the United States, it was by train. So you find all the plantings along the railroad lines in the U.S.
Yep.
So as you studied this, what do you think was most impactful or most important in your own faith journey when you looked at the history of the church in the Netherlands? You joined at age 17. So your life experience has been pretty extensive since you were a young person when you joined. But how did this impact you and your discipleship?
Yeah, I came to the church in the early 70s. And that was when we had in Europe what we then called the International Youth Camps, which was new. It was started in the early 70s. And I met some of my school friends who were with the Community of Christ. I met them. And more or less, they invited me to go as well. And that was the occasion when we went to Dunfield House in England. I was from a poor family, so we didn't have money to go on holidays. So I talked to my parents because I thought for me this was a unique opportunity to go on holiday in a safe surrounding abroad, which was completely new to me. If I didn't go to church, fine, then at least I had a nice holiday out of it. That was the basic idea. So my parents, members of the Dutch Reformed Church, they helped me and said, well, we will see if we can find, I think it was 300 guilders. So that was around 120 euros, which is around $150, more or less, which was quite an amount in the early 70s. But we found them. So I got inspired there. And a year later, I was baptized. Because I found there something new. It touches my heart, and those camps were of a unique structure. And if you look down the lines of, let's say, the European and the British Isles leaderships over the last, let's say, 40, 50 years, most of them, I think 80%, maybe even more, originate from those youth camps. And then you talk also guys like Andrew Bolton, Mike Botts, well, a huge amount of others were all there as youngsters and stayed. I think even guys, he just passed away, Greg Savage was there, just as an example, but many were there. And there I started my journey, and which eventually led to all kinds of leadership roles, etc. But there it all started. And I think that was very important. And it still is important to find as youth, a kind of a sound base where you can say, here is my faith-based. Here is my foundation, my own foundation, my own experience. And from here on, I move on.
That's very helpful. Case, a lot of our listeners are learning about Community of Christ by listening to Project Zion podcasts. And one of the questions we often receive is, how does Community of Christ shape the discipleship of children and youth? And our response is usually, well, mainly through our camping program, our youth camping program. And you are a wonderful example of that, of your experience at the camping program turning into a life of faithful leadership and ministry. So for our listeners, there are other episodes about the camping program, but Case gives us a good example of what it looks like from the inside.
I think there's a nice historical study in the effects of those international youth camps and how it has shaped the European church.
So is that your next historic sites lecture, Case? Will that be next year?
I don't know, because next to this one, I already had another invitation, because as you mentioned, The church in Netherlands started in 1924. So it's only 2 years away that the church in the Netherlands is existing 100 years. So people already spoke to me and said, are you going to write a book about 100 years history? So that is already a kind of a challenge, because my lecture has also been captured in a booklet. So there's even a book for my lecture.
Oh, marvelous. Who are the individuals on the front?
That is, I hope we can see it on the camera, but this is Pyle, who was the music leader in Rotterdam. And this is Veenstra, who was the missionary in the north.
Right. And he's the one who, his wife is the one who sang?
His wife, sorry?
Was his wife the woman who sang, that people came and listened to the singing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was his wife.
Excellent.
Exactly. So I compiled all my text and I added all kinds of pictures to it, because some pictures were lost. Because at one time, Joey Williams, his laptop was stolen. So all the illustrations were on his laptop and it was all gone. So I had some help with people, members in Rotterdam, and we went through all the archives in Rotterdam in order to find all kinds of old pictures in order to illustrate my lecture more.
So for folks who are going to watch this on the archives at historicsites.org, historicsitesfoundation.org, they'll be able to see all those slides of the photos as you give your lecture. So
yeah, and I have sent already two copies of the booklet to Barbara.
To the historic team. Good.
Yes.
Good.
It should be somewhere already in head office. So
perfect. So I find it interesting, Case, that your first international travel was going to youth camp and your life took you to 50 countries after that. So
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Some of them were holidays, but some of them were connected to my profession. And I must honestly say, I was one of the first employees of my company to go beyond the iron, what's then called the Iron Curtain. So I've seen those countries as they were in the communist time.
Right.
So I went to countries like Hungary and Romania, which is not that bad, but I also went to Macedonia, to Albania, Slovenia, Bulgaria, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and all these kinds of nice places. And I've seen it as in the old times, as how people lived, how limited their living was, how hard existence basically was. And those are stories who have also shaped my life. I've seen the market in Uzbekistan, which is a 24 hours market. Nowadays, everything in the Western world is 24 hours, but they already had it then. But those people were more happy than we are, because they have no problems with mortgage or with rent or with stocks or with pension or with you name it, because they don't have those problems. The only problem they have is, do I have a place to sleep tonight and do I have food tomorrow? Yes, then I'm happy, because my family is here as well, so I'm happy.
Very simple existence.
Very simple existence, but more happy. And if you go to countries like Ghana, people have the same, but the big difference is in Ghana, everybody is singing all the time.
You have some great stories, Case. Next time at World Conference, when we visit, you may have to share some things with us. This is marvelous. I'm looking forward to future Project Zion podcasts, whether it's on your book that you're going to produce or whether it's on the camping program, whatever it might be. I'm looking forward to hearing more from you about the church, not just in the Netherlands, but also how it influenced the church in other parts of Europe. So do you have any closing thoughts or pieces that you meant to share during our conversation that we didn't get to that you'd like to share before we close?
I think I want to share a little bit about, let's say, the courage and the determination of the first members who got baptized. I think those people, and in Friesland, it were even two women, One of them was 7 months pregnant, and they went into this small river in order to get baptized. And in those days, there are horrible stories that people throw rocks at them. People were disturbing, people were shouting, were cursing. People were seeing them as a kind of a sect. And still, and we talk about here the 30s, where things were very bad economically, etc. But still they persisted. Still they went on, and their belief and their trust in that everything would come to a good end, they just moved on. And I think it's very courageous what these people have done. Because if I could do it myself, I'm not sure if I could do it that way. I think it's very courageous for such simple people, because they could have got fired, or they could have got ignored, or they could have kicked out of the community. Everything could happen in those days. And still, they did it.
So, okay, some of our listeners who have left their faith community in which they've grown up, many of them grew up LDS, and are exploring Community of Christ, are might feel have some feelings of solidarity with those early members, because they are experiencing mm-hmm. similar issues and yeah. have had to be also yeah. persistent and trusting and courageous. So
yeah.
thank you for sharing that. That is a that is part of the history of being a person who seeks a spiritual home in a way that maybe other people either don't appreciate or don't understand. So thank you for that.
You're
and
welcome.
Thank you for being with us today.
Okay.
And sharing no with us. And for our listeners, we do encourage you to view Case's lecture, and that will be housed in the archives on the Historic Sites Foundation website at historicsitesfoundation.org. And if you have additional questions or ideas for Case, he's retired now and he has all the time in the world, right? From what he said, to just
Well,
write
I
lots
think
of-
that's probably the biggest misunderstanding of being retired. I've never been so busy. I cannot imagine how I did it, because I had a full-time job and I still don't know where all the time went. Because if you're retired, people know how to who and know how to find you, even children and grandchildren, especially grandchildren. So
indeed.
They eat your time.
I won't tease you about that anymore, because I am aware that that happens when one yeah. retires, and we appreciate.
But we see it as a great blessing, so don't worry.
And we appreciate your continued leadership and ministry in the life of the church in Europe as well. So for Cup of Joe, part of the Project Zion podcast, I'm Karen Peter. We've been with Case Olengsmith talking about the church in the Netherlands. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.